Okay, begin with, and I hear the feedback, so I'm going to stick back. How do you boil a frog? Besides Nauticon.
You put them in the water first.
Or Mrs. Froggy, but all right, just keep that in mind as we go forward. I'm starting my PhD this year and looking at a lot of aspects of information security, information assurance, the technology society in general, and trying to bring in a little bit of a foreign policy sociology approach to it. So this next hour and a half is going to talk about the digital society, basically our ability to enact self-determination. And it sort of builds on what I've written and spoken about over previous years, both here and elsewhere, but has a lot of new material as well as some updates. So it's not all old stuff. My first cheesy Matrix analogy. The Matrix has you. Well, the only real Matrix movie was the first one. Okay, the other two were just full of Hollywood special effects, and yeah, they were nice and neat and wonderful, but come on. The first one, you could go to a bar and get drunk talking about the philosophy. Or Trinity. Anyway. So, the Matrix has us. Well, what is the Matrix? Well, in our day and age, the Matrix are, number one, self-serving industries that are telling us always what's best for us and our society, best according to their needs, which usually comes down to money. And these folks, these industries, are supported by bad policies and bad laws from, for the most part, politicians who are either ignorant or indentured to these industries. And of course, this is made easier by our clueless IT management, clueless users that we support or have to deal with, lazy administrators. And the bottom line is that all of these factors put together, it facilitates a closed society, a closed network, a closed environment of consumers who are always consuming and buying new things, economically bound to somebody else, not users or persons or individuals. And that's really the underlying theme for the next hour, is going to be talking about some items that are enabling this closed, controlled society of consumers, and talk about what we can do about it. Go back in time first. Way before many of us were born, actually, mainframes ruled the world, such that they were. Big, huge machines filled this room. And a connect in, what did you have? Dumb terminal somewhere hardwired into a port, right? And where did all your data and applications sit? On that dumb terminal in your data center? No, where? On the mainframe, right. Mainframe somewhere down the hall, upstairs, downstairs. Well, as time evolved, Murphy's Law, Moore's Law, and others came into vogue, we started seeing the power of computers get so much faster, data storage increased, networking technologies improved, and we started seeing more mainframes, mini computers, microcomputer desktops, laptops, and now we're at the point where instead of having a central server and dumb clients that are hardwired in, we've got essentially one client, one device that can serve either as a server or a really brilliant client, right? And this can be a server or a client and can talk to pretty much anybody else here or any other computer on the planet. The first part of this chat is going to try to fill in that fourth quadrant. I'm going to take a minute, and as I said, it's not all going to be a security talk because I know this is not an entire security geek audience. So I changed some of my remarks last night and today to reflect the attendance of this conference. But I want to start off talking about what I know best, pretty much, which is IT security, the security culture. And I'm going to start with a term that Bruce Schneier, cryptographer, has called security theater. Security theater, in short, is the illusion of security and making things more secure, while in reality, not doing any of it. But yet it serves very many functions, a ton of functions, except the most critical one, namely improving security, be it IT security, personal security, neighborhood security, homeland security. Let's give a couple of examples of this. Perhaps the best one that comes to mind would be Dimitri. We all know about the Dimitri case with Adobe and the e-reader. Any of you not know about that? Good. All right. What was all the hype about? Adobe had this big product and said, we say it's secure. We've got great security on this. Our documents, you buy our product, create documents. These documents are going to be secure. Dmitry found out, gee, not really. What was Adobe was calling encryption was really ROT 13 encipherment. That's real secure. Published his findings. He was arrested in Las Vegas during DEF CON a couple years ago. Prosecuted. U.S. Attorney's Office got involved. Russian government was involved. He was Adobe had raised the DMCA claims against him, Digital Millennium Copyright Act, saying that he had told the world how to circumvent copyright controls on the Adobe eReader product by simply dispelling the FUD that Adobe was selling, was spinning to sell its products. So if Adobe believes ROT 13 encipherment is strong security, then I'll just get out of the business. You know, what they say goes. That was probably the one of the most high-profile cases of what I call security theater, because Adobe spun this, and the Justice Department spun this as a critical security issue. And it wasn't. And in some cases, it did the world a favor, don't you think? I think so. Other examples of security theater we've seen, unfortunately, since September 11th, CAPS 2. Anybody hear of CAPS 2? CAPS 2 is the new passenger screening system for U.S. airports. Okay. The idea is this database would search credit records and school records and have all these other resources to determine if Nick Farr is a terrorist or potential terrorist or knows anybody who is. Okay, cool.
His name's Omar. He's been on 80-30
flights. Right.
Security check.
He gets flagged.
Yeah, every time.
Yeah. Fellow front here has a friend at work who named Omar and gets stopped. He's in some watch list. He's been profiled 30 times at the airports since he's flown. Security theater in action. Here is all this effort and money being spent to create this huge database of information and be able to wash a person's name through many filters to see whether or not they're terrorist related. Well, you've got over 200 million Americans in this country, people who fly. Okay, even if 1% of that number comes up as positive, and for the most part is, my math is bad, but the idea is that it's a small percentage, but a large number of physical people. Of that 1%, perhaps 5% of that 1% would actually be noteworthy terrorist related. So there's a lot of false indicators, a lot of false flags, a lot of false alarms. It's like, and we see that all the time with other similar type of databases, credit records. How many folks have had stuff on their credit records that have, you know, been inadvertently placed there by a provider or a retailer? Okay? And then you go get a cell phone and you get declined. And it's like, well, what's going on? Picture that on a much larger scale. You think airport lines are long now. We have the USA Patriot Act, something very near and dear to my heart. Not really. Again, a lot of theater. And there's a lot of theater surrounding how it's being sold to the American people now going forward. I don't know how many of you follow the news regularly, but going into this election season, the president and his cabinet members are saying the USA Patriot Act's primary goal is to break down the wall between law enforcement and intelligence in the war on terror. That's the feel-good rhetoric that they're using. And yes, that is a provision of this law. But they're not talking anything about subpoenaing library records, book purchases, unlawful detentions of Americans or foreigners in transit. Again, it's theater, it's spin, it's hype. And I will also say this also involves much of the IT security industry as well. And by that, I mean, does having more of something mean any better security? We have a lot of times vendors will tell us, and I've worked in large enterprises, and I've seen it from the inside and from the outside, buy more firewalls, get more IDSs. Oh, IDSs are now passe. Let's get intrusion prevention systems. Change the D to a P and charge twice as much. And what's the return on investment? What do we get out of this? I worked on a very large enterprise network a few years ago for the military. Very large, a couple 100,000 users around the world. Every network segment had an intrusion detection system, a real secure sensor on it. Every physical segment. all of these sensors brought their data back to one of five regional security operations centers, monitoring centers, where, as the theory goes, any suspicious activity will be detected and monitored and acted upon. That sounds good, right? Well, now, I'm sure there are people here who are much more technical than I. If you have 300,000 users on a network, how much traffic is that going to generate on any type of network sensor? A fair amount, right? If you're piping all this data back to a central monitoring location, let's say you've got a dozen people per duty shift, per 12-hour shift, monitoring this. How long do you think it's going to be between when an incident or something weird happens and it's noticed and acted upon at the headquarters? Perhaps two, maybe three duty shifts. Because the amount of data that's being generated overwhelms any type of technology that these folks can afford. But yet, these folks in the military will go to Congress and go to the media and say, we've got all this great security. And the reality is, this is reactive, because by the time these monitoring folks know what's going on, the bad guys are already gone or covered his tracks. We see this also in the PKI industry, for example. A couple of years ago, the biggest, largest buzzword was PKI, digital certificates. Everybody had to have one. It was all the rage. It was the electronic version of the Cabbage Patch doll. We all loved it. You know, buy one. You know, it's customized just for you. Little personalized birth certificate, you know, same thing. And where's PKI now? Exactly. It's nowhere. It's used in very specific niche applications, never took off as this wonderful technology to secure the internet. VeriSign's sweating it out. And again, the reality is, did we really need it to begin with? When I was working at VeriSign a couple of years ago, we were told by our CEO, if we're selling certificates, we should use them ourselves. That makes good sense. I mean, if I'm selling Fords, I should drive a Ford and know how it works. So we all of our email was signed with digital certificates. I was doing a customer service meeting up in Toronto, and I get this email from my deputy, and it was encrypted and secured. And at the time, Microsoft's Outlook web client could not handle S/MIME encrypted mail. So I get this high priority message from my deputy that I can't read, and I'm sitting, 500 miles away. I go running out across the hotel, get my laptop, to dial in to see what's going on. His message, hey guys, I'm going out for lunch. Who wants to join us? Is my deputy's lunch plans a matter of corporate security? Do you know how much downtime we lost with me, running to get all the stuff taken care of? The lesson here is, did we need to encrypt every single piece of mail on our network? No. I mean, they were giving certs to call center representatives who were just emailing their bosses, hey, I'm taking my smoke break down. Why? I learned at that point, that was like a 2x4 in the face, that if more is not necessarily better, if you're going to deploy a technology, whatever it is, be it wireless, be it firewalls or IDSs, think about where you're going to deploy it and then deploy it smartly. The idea is, don't just throw more money at what you think is a problem, because the only thing more money solves is the vendor's profit lines. The antivirus industry is another great example of security theater. Brian Martin, Jericho over at Attrition, and I did a couple of articles earlier in the spring after MinMail came out, slamming the antivirus industry for what was clearly their attempt to pimp their products on the world. And it was crazy to see, number one, how the industry refused to standardize on a naming system. So what was MooMail 3 here was Bravo Moo here, was something else there, and as a result, everybody was competing to be the first to market the new press release saying, we just detected this one, when it was detected a week ago by somebody else under a different name. Antivirus industry is one example, another example of security theater in action. Perhaps the largest purveyor of security theater and spin is the folks in Redmond. It's been almost 3 years, and they are still committed to trustworthy computing. I'm curious to know what exactly that is, because I've not seen any indication they've made any progress whatsoever in this direction. 2 years ago, Microsoft took a stand down. It took 1 month to review all the code in Windows XP to look for security vulnerabilities. They stood down. No new development. February of 2001, I think it was, they shut down for a month to review all the code. The shortest month of the year, 40 plus million lines of code. shortest month of the year, Microsoft. Commitment to security. You see where this is going. Neither do I. The problem is that they are so, I mean, I use Microsoft as an example, but it's not limited, as we'll see in a couple of minutes here. It's theater. You can go to Google and look up committed to security, trustworthy computing, and count the numbers of sound bites that vendors like Microsoft and others make towards improving security for the better. But the reality is nothing much has changed, because it's not in their economic interest to change that much that quickly. Think about it. If all of a sudden Windows miraculously was fixed, and every buffer overflow, which is synonymous with what Windows means, was resolved, and Windows was a perfect operating system, think of the economic devastation that would occur. All the MCSEs and MCPs and MCSAs around the world would be out of jobs. Most of the security companies will be out of contracts because there wouldn't be buffer overflows in Windows environments to sell products to and for. Service providers would need to worry about running scans on Windows environments because there wouldn't be any problems to scan for. So that's a bit of a hyperbole, but you see where I'm going. It's not in a vendor's economic interests to move too quickly or in some cases even deal with this at all. Looking at the government is famous for security theater. Anybody here involved in the government doing IT security? One or two? Are you familiar with the term certification and accreditation? Give us a 30-second overview of what that is. Okay, let me fill you in. Give me the reality, please. Well, I'll set you up. Certification and accreditation is a formal process in the Department of Defense and the federal government by which any new computer, a server or a workstation or a laptop, must go through a process to show what it's going to be used for, what's on it, who's going to use it, who owns it, who's going to support it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's about 20 pages of checklists, paperwork, and signatures per device. That's the process. That's the background. Does your reality differ from that background? Yeah. Bullshit. That's a good term.
IT usually happens after the fact.
What do you mean?
They quite often do CNA after.
Exactly. Oh, yes. Well, that's a given. CNAs rarely occur beforehand. Which, when should you put security into your systems? Beforehand. This fixes the problem by addressing it. And we do this paperwork exercise. We all feel good that we know what's going on. But the reality of the fact is, this does little if anything to improve our security other than let us know what we've got. And even then, folks that have done CNAs don't know what they have. They find new devices on their network all the time. As I said, it's more of the same stuff. The more problems we have keeps people like me employed, people like you employed. One of the large problems we see today with our society in general is that we're tolerating and rewarding mediocrity in our products and services. And I've asked this of all my audiences, whether they're in the government or the private sector, why do we continue to throw good money after bad? I go into a Fortune 500 company, and I brief their board of directors, and I say, if it costs you X million dollars to buy something, and it costs you X squared or X cubed per year to maintain it, support it, fix it, or cost you in terms of downtime because you can't do work, are you getting money or losing money? And they shake their heads and scratch and say, well, in a purely business sense, we're losing money. So, well, why don't your shareholders know about this and shouldn't you really be concerned about that? And the looks are just, well, this is the way we're doing business because that's the way we're doing business. So until the human nature changes, we're not going to see market improvements in any aspect of security. And the result, security theater continues to become the norm for how we look at security in the information age. I talk about Trojan troubles. I don't mean faulty condoms. Talking about things that we're allowing to come into our environments without our knowledge, or even with our knowledge, including the unspoken features. Some features include back orifice and similar type of hacker products that exploit default features in Windows, Unix, other OSs. Why do we allow our email client to be so tightly integrated with our operating system to allow my address book to be raped, pillaged, and plundered by some miscreant sending out I love you messages to everybody in my address book? why should anybody here be able to send me a message saying, evacuate the building now using the Windows messaging function? Anybody ever done that? Isn't that an awesome thing to do in an office environment? Does anybody not know what I'm talking about with this?
I personally like to just scare the kid, scare the crap out of kids in my computer lab and start doing stupid crap.
Exactly. Well, let me put this in a different perspective. What if post 9/11, I'm working for some government building or Microsoft or Apple or anybody, well, Apple, they don't use Windows, but some other place, and I do a message that says, a bomb has been reported, please evacuate immediately. And I do a net send to everybody on the LAN. How much downtime is that going to cost my company? Just a thought. We talk about Trojan troubles, and I'm not going to go too deeply into a lot of these because you all are familiar with a lot of the concepts, but if you're not, please raise your hand. I'm concerned that going forward, we're seeing a convergence of IT security, vendor economic security, and I'll say content security coming together. And the idea is to make the world safer for everybody. You know, make the world safe for democracy, make the world safe for users. And let's just look at some of the initiatives. Over the past year, as Microsoft has been touting its next version of Windows, they've said the features of this Windows will do everything from protect your content, prohibit sharing of copyrighted material, defend against spam, hackers, crackers, wares, pirates, MP3, streaming audio, buffer overflows, and every other buzzword that has made media headlines in recent years. There's no such thing as a silver bullet. But this is what they're using to sell the next version of Windows and help get the public's trust or regain trust in their product. But the convergence of these technologies means that unless something changes, our machines could essentially turn into dumb terminals. Because no longer might all of our applications of data reside here. It might be a 50-50 split somewhere. We may have to log into a central server somewhere to authenticate, to prove that this copy of Windows or Mac OS is a licensed copy for that year. We may only get 20% of our product features, and the rest will be sent down to us as we need from a server, a la carte. I create a document in Word, I can send it to Nick, but Nick can't send it to somebody else, even though there's nothing in there that's important or proprietary. We're seeing some of these features built into products like Microsoft Office right now. And it's coming down in other areas as well with software as a service and centralized single logons such as .NET. We've also seen security, the term security in a larger context, used as that justification for marketing. As I mentioned, the next version of Windows will secure you against everything. It'll secure you against you. I haven't heard that, but that's what I'm getting at. Back last year, did anybody hear about the report that compared open source software to supporting terrorism? Anybody remember that? There's a firm, a small research think tank, and by small I mean maybe about a dozen people in a townhouse somewhere in Washington, D.C., called the Alexis de Tocqueville Institute. They released a report that said, a press release, in the middle of March last year, 2 years ago, last year, that said, open source software aids and abets terrorist activity. And then they said, we have a report coming out that'll tell you more in depth and why. It hurts national security. Well, of course, people in the Slashdot crowd, you know, that was on the front page of Slashdot, and, you know, 500 comments and, you know, many trolls. The report finally came out on a Monday. I pulled it down and looked at it. 33 pages, two paragraphs dealing with IT security. The rest of it showed the economic impact comparing open source software, i.e., Linux, against proprietary economic content software such as Windows. Some reporters did some digging around. It turned out that Microsoft is a strong supporter of this think tank. So they wondered that this report was slamming Windows. But still, when the report was hyped, what was it heralded as? Open source software is a threat to national security. What they should have said was open source software may present a threat to existing economic security or vendor profit security. But again, by spinning it a certain way, they got headlines, the report came out, and they were laughed at by everybody, including me. It's a funny report. You know, do a searching and find it. It's hysterical. But again, this showed me that security, the concept of security, especially after 9/11, has been used to sell anything. You want to sell a widget, say it'll defend against terrorists. You'll make a million. Call it an e-widget, and it'll guard against cyber terrorists. You'll gain 2 million. But 2 years ago, another enterprising, I'll say hacker, or /dotter, first place to check every morning is /dot, noted that there was a series of critical updates that were required for the Microsoft Media Player, fixed 3 critical vulnerabilities, not medium or high, critical. You had to download this patch and it'll make you current. Now, who here runs Windows? Be honest. Okay. How many folks, when they download Windows software, read the software license agreement when it comes down? Be honest. Okay. Well, that's not quite the same as reading it, but I'll give you partial credit. This enterprising /dotter read the software license agreement, something that 99% of the world doesn't do, myself included at times. And that's what he found. And for those of you, can you read it in the back okay? All right. Digital rights management, security. You agree that in order to protect the integrity of content and software protected by digital rights management, secure content, Microsoft may provide security-related updates to the OS components that will be automatically downloaded onto your computer. These security-related updates, nice word, may disable your ability to copy and/or place secure content and use other software in your computer. If we provide such a security update, we will use reasonable efforts to post notices on a website explaining the update. This was part of the license agreement for Windows Media Player 8's critical security update from, I think it was June of 2002. A couple of things about this that strike me as a little bizarre. If I'm wrong, please correct me. From a security perspective, and note Microsoft does say this is related to security, they're going to automatically download stuff onto my machine with or without my knowledge. And that stuff that they download may not only change my system configuration, but break other software that's on my system that I might need. Am I comfortable with that? Should I be accepting this? This doesn't sound quite secure to me. But I'm not to worry because Microsoft says that they will post notices on a website explaining the update. Okay. I'm running OS X here. I've got Apache on here. Give me a minute, I'll have a website. Not accessible to anybody, but it'll be a website. Yeah. So any changes to this policy, indeed, will be posted on a website. I just can't get access to it if I'm an outside user.
It doesn't even say able to do it. It says reasonable
efforts. It's no reasonable efforts. I mean, I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt. Okay. But from a security perspective, this terrifies me.
Yeah.
And this terrifies the folks I speak to in government and the commercial sector about this because they have no idea on many things, but especially stuff like this. I mean, here you are by signing off, by updating your computer to close down a critical vulnerability. You are basically saying, here, you have free root access to my machine anytime you want to update certain components. That's very frightening. And that affects, in a security sense, your confidentiality, your integrity, and possibly the availability of your information resources. Very, very scary. But again, we're accepting this at face value, just clicking OK. Lawyers are having a field day in this digital age. Haven't you noticed that? I mean, I'm sure this went through 4 or 5 legal reviews. Speaking of lawyers and legal reviews, we all know about SCO. I'm not going to go into them too much. Oracle, in their software license agreement a few years ago, told PC Magazine that they could not publish benchmark testing results of Oracle comparison with SQL Server databases in their magazine. Or PC Magazine was going to. Oracle says, reread the terms and conditions. You can't do this. Network Associates said the same thing about comparing antivirus signature quality of numbers of viruses found versus semantics, numbers of viruses found, and things like that, or total number of viruses detected. And starting last year, I started seeing CDs at Best Buy that had inserts of legalese this is an extended media format or whatever, some Universal Special, Britney Spears, whoever, album. It may not work on your computer. It may not work on some CD players. And if it breaks while inside your computer, don't blame us. Very frightening stuff. But again, you know, where do we draw the line? I'm waiting for books to come out with the software license agreement in them. You know, hard copy, you know. We've all heard about DMCA. I'm not going to dwell on it, but this is probably one of the largest, one of the two largest legal issues we have to overcome, and it's been the bane of many of our existence. And in terms of looking at how we're going forward as a technology society, it bears a little bit of time to discuss briefly. There are four key components or aspects of DMCA. First one, as we know, is it makes it illegal to traffic in what they call circumvention devices, devices that will allow you to circumvent copyright controls of a third party. All right, I can understand that from a business perspective. However, there's a fine line between business perspective, lawyers, and common sense. Somewhere there's got to be a happy balance, and there isn't. Sony Music spent $20 million a few years ago to develop copy-proof CDs. Brilliant. I mean, they were suffering. Napster was around. You know, Kazaa hurt them economically. So they spent $20 million to come up with a copy-proof CD. Again, an enterprising hacker, and I use the term in the broadest sense, found out that if you took a black Sharpie marker and you drew a ring around the outer ring of the CD, the copy protection was gone, and you could do whatever you wanted to the disc. They spent $20 million. $20 million only to be beat by a $3 laundry marker. Now, by my telling you that, I have broken the law. All right? I have told you not only how to circumvent, but I've told you where to go find devices that will allow you to circumvent.
But now we're all criminals.
Well, no, because yes, you are, because you now know. You know, and in this case, knowing is all the battle. Who got that reference? good. I'm not that old. By the way, G.I. Joe's out on DVD now, the old cartoon series. I saw Best Buy, they've got a box set, like the first two or three seasons on DVD. It's like 50 or 80 bucks. I was like, yeah, whatever it was, yeah. Yeah. But this raises the lunacy behind this law just raises you know the level of discussion and debate. So what the hell are we doing? And going forward, what are we getting ourselves into? Let's look at what this this law means for First Amendment protections. E-voting systems and the whole Diebold fiasco. All right? Now, I don't want some law that was built to keep software, music, and movie companies profitable affecting the future of my democracy. That's just me. I mean, I may not be a Marxist, but I mean, I believe that. We see the case where a company, I think it was called Universal Garage Door Openers, sued a competitor.
Right.
Okay.
Yep.
Why? Why did they sue?
They had rolling codes in their thing, so that somebody couldn't snarf the code over the airwaves. Mm-hmm. Somebody came up with a universal replacement, so you didn't have to buy their brand name replacement.
Right. Same thing with Lexmark. Lexmark took a printer inkjet refill company to court saying that, well, this company violated our copyright controls over our proprietary codes on the inkjet containers to say when it's time for a refill. Okay, where's that fine line? I mean, there are business interests, but there are broader interests. Talking about something isn't necessarily illegal. Doing something actually is. I mean, if I know that Nick needs air to breathe. And a few years ago, he needed a bottle of gin. You sat up front for a reason. You knew you were getting into this. I also know that if I take my two hands and I wrap them around Nick's neck and squeeze real hard, two things are going to happen, if not more. One, he's going to get hurt.
I will jack you up.
And two,
if, he has a posse.
And two, if I don't let go, either A, he's going to get sick, or B, he's going to die. Why? Because I know he needs air to breathe. Knowing he needs air to breathe and knowing if I cut off that air supply will cause bad things to happen does not make me a murderer. Actually doing it makes me a murderer. Apply that to cyberspace. There's no difference. By the way, let's take a quick look at some of the hypocrisy behind DMCA. The motion picture industry started off in New York and New Jersey, but because Thomas Edison had all the patents over motion picture photography and was charging exorbitant fees for royalties and licenses, the studios, Paramount and Fox, said, screw you, we're going west, out of your reach, out of the reach of the law at the time, and that's where Hollywood's motion picture cities got born. So that sounds a lot like, you know, Kazam moving down to the Netherlands or Australia or wherever else, or the Playfair folks moving to India to escape Apple. You know, this isn't three times?
For a time,
yes. They're going to move somewhere else. I don't know where yet. The recording industry and the music industry, the radio industry, the same thing. They agreed that, okay, if someone makes a song and plays the song, they're entitled to whatever monies they're entitled to. But if a radio station plays a song or makes copies or a company copies the song and sells it, then the record producer and not the recording artist gets the money. That's why we saw the whole webcasting fees thing over the internet in recent months. And the funny thing is when you read the fine print, radio stations, real radio stations, broadcast stations, they don't pay that type of money that the webcasters are being forced to pay. The internet is no different. They're both streaming bits and bytes and data. But because it's the internet and we don't fully understand it yet, we're charging more money. No different than if I decided to basically pull off the local radio station here and rebroadcast it on a CBS channel. You know, I could do that for free. Not legal, but I could do it for free. And perhaps the first Napster was cable TV. Okay? And they did something that Napster never did. They not only stole content, they charge people to access it. Napster didn't charge anybody. Well, they do now, but different Napster. So Hollywood was built, and Larry Lessig's new latest book, Free Culture, goes into this history in really, really good detail, going back to RCA and Edison and others. But his major conclusions is that Hollywood was born, in a lot of ways, is based on piracy, particularly when there's very little stuff that's new that can be created. You got a copy of Free Culture right there, actually. That is either Free Culture or Mao's Red Book. Which is it? That is Free Culture. Okay. You had a question?
Interesting point. I was thinking about this one day. Disney, who we all know is a big, lovable, huggable, nice corporation, they benefited greatly in their beginning by using public domain music.
Correct.
Orchestra pieces.
And books.
Books.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
But you know what I'm saying? All their scores to all their early cartoons were at the time public domain and freely usable.
Correct.
Orchestra. And whatnot. And today, they rapidly defend their copyright to the Sonny Bono protection.
Yes. Disney is...
They wouldn't exist if it wasn't for the fair use of the time.
Correct. See, Disney is a great example. Disney wants its cake and eat it too. Okay? They have no problems taking from the public domain things that they want to make into a blockbuster movie.
Fairy tales,
whatever the case will be. The Grimm brothers, all the Grimm fairy tales, most of them are, in their current iteration, are owned by Disney.
Yeah.
And if you want to make a parallel version of Hansel and Gretel, you're going to have the lawyers from Disney come breathing that down your back saying that's too close to what we did. Okay? Steamboat Willie was Disney's first major motion picture type of little cartoon thing. Okay? It was based on a very similar cartoon done a couple of years prior by some no-name person. It was a cartoon. Maybe it was a previous iteration, regardless of Steamboat Willie. A fellow named Willie, who's a steamboat operator. All right, Disney didn't pay them anything. Based Steamboat Willie's cartoon off of this, made fortunes off of it. That was what 70, 80 years ago. Technically, it should have been in the public domain now. But as you just heard, it's still under copyright. Every time Mickey's is about to come back into the public domain, you know, he gets another shot in the arm for another 50 years.
Yeah.
You know, Mickey Mouse will never die.
Who gave him that shot?
Congress
gave him that shot. You see, the way this little side detour, thank you, Nick, is that Congress is owned by two industries, the defense establishment and the entertainment establishment. Okay? Every time Mickey's about ready to croak, The entertainment folks come to Washington and say, "Hey, Senator Farr, you're due for re-election next year, aren't you? How much can we support you? Let's take you to dinner and the Magic Kingdom and ride Cinderella's ride and talk." And amidst the chorus and amidst the tunes of "It's a Small World After All," they're saying, "Well, Senator, we'll give you $50,000 this year and $150,000 next year if you vote for another 20-year extension of copyright." What Lessig comes back to say is that it's only a matter of you cannot take material that I think is from pre-1929 is the earliest you could take material from. This is in the public domain under current copyright law. That's scary. Okay? And in 96, as Nick said, Sonny Bono Copyright Act, they extended it for another 20 years. We'll do it again soon after. In fact, Mary Bono, Congressman, Sonny's wife, lives in my building. And every time I see her, I glare at her. She has no idea why. One of these days, I'm gonna go to the gym, wear some like copyright control shirt, and be like, glare at her. But going back on topic, as we're looking at these issues, whether it's copyright control or software controls, whatever the case would be, we're seeing a conflicting whack-a-mole environment. On one hand, you've got the evolution of technology and knowledge. And on the other hand, you've got laws and clueless people and other technologies trying to stifle it.
It's an arms race.
Exactly. It's a cyber arms race. I mean, think about it. They say, well, file sharing is illegal. Okay, Napster is bad. No one said a word about FTP.
IRC.
Email. Sneakernet. Floppy disk. I mean, no one said that. It was all because the internet enabled it. That was the key discriminator, the internet. Very, very frightening stuff, and it's very hypocritical. Because on one hand, the internet gives the content providers a lot of distribution. And they're terrified because we, as the content providers, producers, can cut them out of the equation a lot of times. Look at the independent music movement. The recording industry hates them because they can go directly to the consumer. I loved MP3.com. Hollywood hated it. But they keep trying, they being the bad, the corporate suits, and to a lesser extent, the Congress folks, trying to overcome the advancements of technology and knowledge. Think about it. RIA's suing Verizon to have them disclose the names of people that the recording industry thinks is breaking the law. A private company serving subpoenas? I thought this was America. Maybe it's the best law money can buy. I don't know, but that just doesn't sound kosher to me. Diebold made the news today. Did anybody hear about that today? There were some more memos that were leaked. About 50 of them were published by, I think, the Oakland Times, the Oakland Tribune, or something like that. And the paper got a cease and desist letter from Diebold's lawyers saying, you cannot print anything more, and whatever you've printed, don't distribute anymore.
How do you cease and desist on a fucking paper that got printed last Thursday?
Exactly. Well, the idea is, take it off your website. Just mention it, but don't link to it. It's out there. The genie's out of the bottle. Okay? These folks don't get it. Nick.
It is and it isn't that in many ways a lot of cease and desist orders will prevent you from putting that content on LexisNexis. They'll prevent you from turning it out in other places.
Correct.
So unless you have a physical hard copy of the paper that day, there's no microfiche anymore.
Correct.
That information disappears.
Right. And that goes into the whole other issue of how transient is our society. When you see a news article and then you see, it was last updated, 3:55 p.m. It's like, geez. What do the old ones say? What do they cut out or edit or change? But Nick's exactly right, which comes back to the whole issue of full disclosure, vulnerabilities, and information wants to be free, and whatever you want to call it, is publish or perish. All right? If a newspaper thinks that an item is important enough for the public interest, then it has an obligation to publish it and get the word out. And then if they receive the cease and desist letter, it won't make much difference because it's already out there. They include people like Congressman Howard Berman from California, Senator Orrin Hatch, Senator soon to be retiring Fritz Hollings, Senator Dianne Feinstein. Most of these folks are from entertainment districts. Berman wanted to have a bill last year in Congress that would make it okay for copyright holders to attack, probe, scan, and disable other computers that housed copyrighted information illegally. Another term for that is a license to hack. Correct. And they actually bandied around the term terrorism in the committee hearing. So infoterrorism, we'll shut you down. Like, well, give me a break. You know, copyright is not terrorism. You know, take it what you will. Orrin Hatch wants something like $1 million fine per copyrighted song that somebody downloads. Well, he's a musician himself. So are some of you, I'm sure. Besides, the way knowledge and the net and people are, it's impossible to shut us up. If you think about it, we're all like water. You know, water will seek its own level. It will find its way around rocks, around rivers, up, down streams, through dirt and soil, whatever the case would be. Put it in a more geek-like perspective, this is a map of Yugoslavia's network back in 1999 when the U.S. was bombing it during May of 99. Does the network ever really go away, those of you can see?
No.
I hear a no.
We bombed Yugoslavia? No, I'm not trying to be funny. I didn't really know.
Yes, we did. Yes, we did.
We're in Iraq right now also, just like you know.
We also actually... we actually hit the Chinese embassy in that same time period. We had faulty maps.
I went to public school, so...
Yeah. But did the network ever disappear? No. You bomb a power station, we'll find batteries. We'll find generators. You take out a T1, we'll use...
Carrier pigeons.
We'll use phone lines. We'll use CB radio. We'll use Wi-Fi. We'll use something else. The network doesn't go away. And like the network, like knowledge, like water, we'll find a way around whatever obstacles are in our way, be them legal, technical, or procedural. That dawned on me last night. I was like, oh, this is a pretty good analogy. You know, you've got the whack-a-mole world, all these great new technologies, and everyone's trying to ban them or control them or license them or regulate them. But in the grand scheme, things are still getting out. The recording folks will say, well, yes, the transgressions continue. This shows that the world is evil and brutal and out to kill us. Well, the reality is half what they're producing is crap. I mean, how many boy bands, girl bands, single soloists do you need that look, act, dance, sound alike? They're all the same. All right, there are five. Okay, we'll do a petition right here. Nauticon says no more than five identical boy bands or girl bands.
Yeah.
Hey. In one room, maybe. I don't know. Whatever you're interested in. But the reality of this, I mean... Think about what this means. If you produce crap or stuff that people aren't buying, okay, who do you have to blame for this? The customers? Because they're not buying crap? Because the customers value their dollar? They value their money? They perhaps during economic hard times might want to put gas in the truck or food on the table then pay $20 for 10 songs? Can't be the corporation's fault for poor marketing, failure to adapt to new technologies and new way of doing things in society, failure to take advantage of new technologies that would enable them to have deeper market penetration, failure to get better artists,
yeah,
or not pay existing ones $40 million for one album, Mariah Carey. All right. There's more than enough blame to go around, but these folks don't get it. They want to put voice of blame on us and on the technology. Well, sales are down because of pirating. Maybe a little bit.
For the record, Jaguar's not listening.
My fear going forward, though, is are we heading into this kind of a world? And for those of you who in the back who can't read this, this is a copy of Alice in Wonderland from Project Gutenberg, as sold by Adobe in its new e-reader, e-glass book format. Now, for those of you in the back who can't read the fine print, these are the permissions on this electronic copy of Alice in Wonderland that's been around for, what, 200, 300 years. No text selection can be copied from this book to the clipboard. No printing is permitted on this book. This book cannot be lent or given to someone else. This book cannot be given to someone else. This book cannot be read aloud.
Read us some.
And if you doubt me in the back, you could come up and look at the bottom bullet. It says that.
And we wonder why society has such a short attention span. They don't realize that this body got bombed 5 years ago.
Are we heading into a world where we're having technology presume us guilty until we're proven guiltier? Where if I receive a copy of an ebook or a piece of electronic information, a book, a music video, or a DVD, or whatever the case would be, that the software is going to presume I'm going to be a bad guy? I think we're heading in that direction, and that's very frightening. Not to mention, very anti-American, if you think about it. Because I've never been arrested, and I won't ask for a show of hands, but I think you're innocent until proven guilty. I think. Nick, you want to confirm that?
Not according to the state of California.
Oh. Hey, you're from Michigan.
Wait, that's the People's Republic of California, right? Comrade? Okay. But is this where we're headed into basically a technically implemented pre-crime information environment where we're not only guilty until proven guilty when we buy something, but we're also monitored and tracked as to what we can and can't do with it? Now let's go back to security. Talk about some security theater and just some of these issues that are contributing to the decline and fall of the information society as we know it. Those of you who do computer security for a living have probably come across these terms before. On the left-hand side are the three guiding tenets of our profession. Computer security is there to protect the confidentiality, the integrity, and the availability of information and information resources. You've all heard that before, hopefully. On the right side are the three key vehicles that we hopefully use to implement those principles. People, process, and technology. That's hopefully how we do it. But again, thanks to a combination of human failings and security theater, we're not really addressing them all equally. In fact, some of them we're not even addressing at all. We spend tons of money on confidentiality and integrity. We buy new firewalls, do encryption products, deploy all these wonderful whiz-bang things to make us more secure, but forget that if somebody takes out our one network connect, what good is all this technology? We're secure right away. You blow up, you take down the gateway, and then you're instantly secure. So no one's looking at availability issues. What good is all this network security stuff if there's no network to guard?
The internet's supposed to be redundant.
I'm wondering if I should glare at him, throw something at him, or wake him up. On the other side, we buy all these great technologies to allow us to be confidential, maintain integrity, PKI and whatever. We write a lot of policies and processes, do a lot of paperwork, certification and accreditation, but we never focus on the people. How many folks have actually sat through or given a security awareness type of lecture or thing for their employer?
Rubicon!
They're not paying you, are they?
Would you pay me?
Not with your education. Okay. We don't do that. And I'll give you an example. I talked about availability and the problem that we don't really focus on the people aspect of security. A few years ago, I worked on the Navy Marine Corps Internet, this big enterprise project I alluded to before. That's their domestic, long hauls. The domestic long hauls are operated by WorldCom. Okay, fine. WorldCom's got a lot of big contracts. No problem. Bankruptcy aside. Yeah. Not a problem. I mean, bankruptcy stuff aside, that they've got a great network. So if I wanted to really play with them, there were two key points domestically that I've been to both of these points, where if I could degrade or blow these things up or do something there, NMCI, domestic communications, would short circuit, fail to operate. But that's okay. Because, like every good government network, they've got redundancy. They're peered. The heavier blue lines are their big, fat, OC-48s. See, those were OC-3. These are OC-48s. Big, fat pipes. They're the backup. Owned and operated by another unit of WorldCom. So we have multiple pipes, same provider. So you have the two blue dots. Take out the primary. Two big red dots, you cause some pretty major outages. If you want to be more regional, you've got a few other little points you could cause some serious damage. I've been to some of the smaller points as well. Okay. Is this peering, or is this just redundancy, or is it neither? Same company? How much do you want to bet there are sites where these primary and backup links interconnect? Remember, this is a commercial company, cost cutting, convenience of administration. You can have parallel fiber, sure, but those parallel fibers will go through the same conduit, the same office, same sheath, and physically some of the same buildings. Maybe not the same room, the same rack, but I've seen places where I could have just pulled a couple of lines and had some fun. But yet the people in charge of this program believed that they had redundancy in place, they were peered and guarded against any outages. I had a much more detailed briefing that I am not providing here that said, oh, no, sir, you're not. And then they learned why. I did the same thing with their types of firewalls and how they did encryption and the amount of overspending that they did on security products that didn't give them any real value. Again, this comes back to the human factor. People are in charge of these systems, and they're not thinking them through and how they deploy them and how they administer them. Which leads me, of course, to the biggest problem of them all, wetware. The most important computer in the world and the most vulnerable one, easy to exploit. And on a very holistic level, people are responsible for every aspect of technology, right? We conceive the products, we build them, we design them, we code them, we maybe test them, we release them, we sell them, we research them, we buy them, we unpack them, build them, deploy them, administer them, use them, hack them, crack them, defend them, whatever, and legislate and prosecute them. It all comes back to people. We're involved at every step of the way. So unless the way of thinking about these things changes, particularly on the client side, why do we buy exploitable technology? Why do we set ourselves up for redundant failures, for single points of failure, for recurring vulnerabilities, buffer overflows and such? Until we start thinking differently and pushing back, the process will continue. There's never going to be any real change because the culture is not going to adapt. Which brings us back to where we started, the history of computing. We talked about mainframes, minis, evolved into LAN, WAN environments, the internet, wireless. We've got brilliant servers, brilliant workstations that can do a lot of great things. Talked about single points of failure, digital rights management, a little bit about security vulnerabilities. Anybody have any ideas what goes in that fourth quadrant? Anybody?
People.
Good. People? Anything else?
Big question mark.
Well, question mark's there. Say again? Very close.
Monkeys.
We're going back to the future. I believe we're going back to the future. The way we're heading back into the world of centralized computing where we are physically or digitally connected to a central server farm for applications, data, authentication to prove that this OS copy is legitimately licensed to me and paid for the year, that there must be dedicated pipes between me or my organization and the software provider. If that link gets cut, I may not be able to do business. Things like that. Same environment that we had 20, 30, 40 years ago when it was just dumb terminals hardwired into a mainframe.
The internet's supposed to be redundant, except in more
times. I think he's got a scratch. Would you just, move the needle a little bit? And that fourth quadrant is underscored and facilitated by what I call the invisible hand. And Nick, I'm not talking about Adam Smith, the Wealth of Nations. I'm talking about the fact that you've got that first slide about the matrix has you. Clueless politicians, greedy executives, a lot of FUD spinning around, ignorant users who don't know what's going on or who are unwilling to change their way of thinking, and therefore this environment is allowed to bubble up. And like the frog, like boiling the frog, it's happening slowly over time. People outside this room don't generally know this is going on, and if they do notice something odd, like they can't burn a CD or rip a CD, they might shrug it off, oh, I've got a bad CD, or damn it, I'll just try something else. But take a big step back and look at it. This is coming in low under the radar and has been building through the 90s.
The media broadcast flag
is another one. And we'll get to that in a minute. So I think this is where we're actually headed, back to the future. I don't have the picture of the professor, but he would go there. So what does this mean? As I said, such an environment sets us up for single points of failure, or if I'm a bad guy, single points of attack. I no longer need to worry about getting to your workstation or getting hacking, cracking into your environment. If I want to cause mischief or do some sort of, you know, national attack, I just aim at your pipes. Shut down your pipes, and you're, for the most part, dead in the water, unless you've got some really well-thought-out backup plan somewhere. We have the centralized, we're moving towards a centralized server farm, point of administration and authentication. Sign in, you're authenticated, and then you can pull down certain information or have access to certain data that you may not have normally. We're seeing this, the broadcast flag is a great example, where content, innovation, and access is being restricted to a few, and by a few, I mean those with the power and the money. Shutting out the independent people, the independent writers, the musicians. For example, people who write books, unless they're Tom Clancy or Bob Woodward or Danielle Steele, they can walk into any literary company in the world and say, I want you to publish my book. And the company will be like, whoa, sign here. I go into a store, anybody here goes into a recording studio or a publishing company, I want to sell an album, I want you to publish my book. They'd be like, shh, get the hell out of here.
Not if you're Rick Forno, they don't.
Oh, sure they do.
Oh, no way in hell.
Was he drinking? There's a huge disparity here. And again, this favors the, you know, again, there's a very large skewing. As I said earlier, we're being proven guilty until proven guiltier, not by people. Red light cameras, they're great. A lot of judges are throwing out red light camera issued tickets because there's no cop there to actually say, oh, no, you sped up to allow this ambulance to pass by, and that's why the camera got you. Technology doesn't do that. There's no context in technology. It's either yes or no. It's binary. And some judges I know in Washington and Virginia, they've actually said they're tossing out red light speeding tickets, which I think is a great thing. Hopefully that spreads. So how do we deal with some of these problems going forward? I don't have all the answers, and I haven't even discussed half of the problems. Well, another cheesy matrix analogy, we need to disconnect ourselves. You know, we need to leave this theater of security and content security and the glamour of .com this and information enabled that and think for ourselves. If we see a hot new technology, we want to buy it and play with it, that's great. But when we incorporate it into our lives, into our office places, what also are we incorporating? Vulnerabilities, dependencies, other things, hidden vulnerabilities that we don't know about. And we won't know about until 6 months, a year or two after we've deployed these things. Wireless was all the rage, is all the rage. Companies are doing wireless left and right. And yet you can walk down any hallway in any company and latch onto their network. No authentication required. Because it's cool, it's available, and it's popular. So again, think for yourself. Do we need wireless? If so, great. Where do we need it and why? Or PKI, or fill in the blank. Do we need HGTV? I would say no. I really could care less. But that's where we're headed, and we have no choice but to buy an HGTV at some point. Fine. But the world, the people just do not realize that buying HGTV, digital TV, also means that within a year, we're going to start having the broadcast flag. And when I try to record on my TiVo something, and then take that TiVo and copy it to my computer, I might not be able to do that.
Or you have to pay to broadcast like, as an independent producer.
Correct. Or I have to be pay for or be registered or licensed as a producer to send a TiVo recorded picture from my living room to my bedroom. That's the direction we're headed. Exactly. It all comes back to money. So conferences like this, articles, lectures, ways of thinking, the whole idea is to change and close the wetware vulnerability, which comes back to how we're looking at technology and the information society going forward. It's not good enough to just throw money at the problem, because a lot of times money is the problem. Money in terms of the people trying to sell us more things that we don't need or want. The bottom line is we need to deal with reality. What's going on, as they're saying now in the military, on the ground? What's the reality of the technology environment that we're dealing with? I don't want reassurances that things are going to be any better off with product X or product Y, that Longhorn is going to be my silver bullet for guarding against any problems I might have. Okay? I want to know what's going to happen for real. Don't spin it. Don't put me in a security-oriented theater. Tell me now. Don't tell me. Don't give me promises of movies on demand to any room in my house. But to get that nice new carrot, I have to give up my personal liberties or my privacy or my convenience to get it. If you're going to offer me something, then full disclosure. Tell me all the risks and the vulnerabilities associated with it.
What would
E-voting is a great one. One last matrix analogy. Do you want real security, be it IT, personal, social, technical security, or the illusion, the feel-good reassurances of security? It's up to you. In my government audiences, I actually have much many more matrix analogies, and I call this, you know, the red pill prescription. Take the red pill. And it's amazing, a lot of folks in the government have never seen the matrix. So I have to tell them the whole red pill and, you know, batteries and whatnot. But, yeah. Exactly. Okay. Are there any quick questions or comments? What I tried to do for this little over an hour was to just go over a couple of, at a very high level, some issues that I see in the IT security world and the technology society that I think are directly relevant to people at this conference. We've got security geeks here, we've got artists, musicians, and I think there's something here that hopefully addressed everybody's, you know, interests, professions, whatever. If I'm right or wrong, hey, I don't really care. But if you leave here and you're thinking a little differently about what I said or, you know, what I've discussed, some of the ideas, if you leave here thinking a little differently, then I've done my job. So in that case, I'm happy. If you want to talk either here or outside, I'll be around. Before we go, or break, since there are no questions apparently, let's have a little bit of, oh, one question.
When you're talking about PKI, you're talking about PKI as implemented in email, not PKI as a whole. Like, Windows 2000
uses
PKI. The VPN
uses PKI. Yeah. Well, PKI in terms of email encryption and digital certificates, yeah, like for email, for common access card logins, like in the government, those issues, yeah.
Because everybody uses PKI,
yeah. Correct. PKI, again, in terms of like email encryption or like the common access card for the government logins, those sort of things. Okay, now let's have a little bit of fun since this is a sort of a geeky conference.
Woohoo!
Fun. And Nick is still here too, which is nice.
Oh, no.
Three for one. No porn. Well, actually, no, there is some porn.
Porno!
I've assembled what I will call a digital wall of shame. And this could include any of the following: Uber lords of the information age, clueful leaders of business and politics, greedy, hypocritical, frightened little children who need to get a life, get a clue, and get fill in the blank, and otherwise people that won't win. There may also be others involved that I will say no more at this point. Feel free to jeer, shout, or throw things at the screen, but not me. Zeke Heil, Jack Valenti, who is now retiring as head of the Motion Picture Association.
Yeah, but what's next?
That's a lot like Dave Dreamus, you know.
He does. Who his replacement will be, we don't know yet.
John Ashcroft.
Would you buy a CD from this guy? Carrie Sherman from the Recording Industry Association. Wonder what he was drinking when this picture was taken. Must have been a pretty desperate girl. I will say, Kari is filling in the role of both chairman and president because Hillary Rosen had resigned last year to, I guess, going to commentate for CNBC. Hillary Rosen was the former president of the RIA. I will say, in her defense, in her final months and since then, she's actually said that, yeah, you know, some of the things we were proposing were really goofy and wrong, and I'm sorry to have done it, but that's what the record guys wanted. So I'm not giving her, you know, kudos, but I'm just, you know, I'm giving her half credit for at least having some sanity. The first one?
He's getting a blowjob too.
Damn it, Frodo, stop it. I mean, really, damn it. Did you find the ring yet? Okay. Moving on. Anybody recognize these fine gentlemen? Anybody recognize? On the left, I heard it in the audience. Darryl McBride, CEO of SCO. And on his right, his partner in crime, Chris Sontag, the head of the SCO Source program. Two people who I think definitely belong on the digital wall of shame because neither of them have a clue about digits, or shame, or they wouldn't be doing what they're doing. Thank you, Jason Scott, wherever you are. You gave me the idea last night.
Hey, that's a copyright violation.
Fair use. This is an educational conference. I'm educating. More concerned with covering up nudity on Lady Justice than fighting terrorists.
Janet Reno and drag.
Janet Reno was a better attorney general than this guy.
Sad to say, but
yes. Also, but incidentally, those of you who have been here, you may not have been following the news, there's this major 200-person bust copyright control infringement arrest this week. Something like $50 million worth of wares and equipment were seized around the world by a DOJ-sponsored investigation into intellectual property controls. So again, we've got $200 million seized, agents spent time and money going after copies of Britney and copies of XP, as opposed to, oh, I don't know, let me think, maybe terrorists?
He belongs to a religion that forbades dancing.
I'm not going to, I'll talk about him offline. I'm not going to make those comments here. Although I will say he actually is an anointed person. I don't know if you know about this, but when he was sworn in as Attorney General, before he went to his swearing in, his wife anointed him with Crisco in the tradition of the Orthodox Christian sect, Baptist sect that he follows. So he thinks he's like an anointed one, whatever. Anyway. Anybody recognize this fine gentleman? Any guesses? Michael Powell, FCC chairman. Person who believes that less media is better and that why have 20 million channels when you can have 5?
There's no oversight for the FCC.
Well, he is the oversight.
Oh, well, I feel safe.
And finally, the digital wall of shame. On the left is a drunken, passed out Tredesser from RC3. After he was my partner at NFS T-shirts, actually. That was the same night, by the way, that was Nick's night. And we have on the bottom right an illustrious Nick Farr, who actually has a non-alcoholic beverage in his hand in this picture. Which is a kudos to him, because after RC3, I was terrified for this boy's life. So, props to him. He's actually come a long way. I'm happy for it. Hence, he makes the digital wall of shame, but not in a shameful manner. I was going to use pictures from RC3, but I decided against it. I have
Thank you.
I have some video clips, too, of Nick, you know, when we were rolling him out on the luggage cart, but I decided, nah, enough is enough. So, not here. So this was some of the digital wall of shame. What I wanted to do was just kind of wrap up a little bit of fun, kind of just highlight some of the folks that I think are probably the most dangerous people in our particular industries and professions. Hopefully we did. Hopefully you got some information out of this. If you did, great. If you want to talk later on, that's fine. Don't throw things at me. It's 4:25. I finished up half hour early. Surprise, surprise. Are there any questions or comments? No. All right, well, if the bar is open, that's where you'll find me.